You just have to understand that we're not going to change the way we handle her based on your feelings for her. We have to go textbook on this. That's fair, I say. She's innocent, after all. So go take care of her family, then get back here and help us with all this.
When he reaches out to shake my hand, I shake.
You got it, Chief.
I feel a little more buoyant as I walk back down the hall.
49. Casey. I have to hand it to Billy. He's done a good job working out my surrender. He arranges for us to have a police escort as we head for the department to turn myself in. As 6 police cars encircle us with their sirens blaring and their lights flashing, I feel a little sick. I watch the sides of the road, looking for someone with a grenade launcher, and scan the windows for gun barrels. Keegan could ram his car into us and explode a bomb. He could simply have a dirty cop in one of the cars guarding us, or a guard at the jail who would let him get to me. Even if I'm safe from Keegan, I'm scared. The whole time I've been running, I've told myself it was because I didn't want to be murdered if Keegan caught me. But now that it's just jail that I face, I'm still scared.
You okay, Casey?
Barbero asks as he follows the police cars toward the department.
I guess.
You look pale, Marge says, glancing back. Did you eat this morning?
No, my stomach wasn't very steady.
You look like you're about to pass out.
I'll be okay, I say.
We round the corner a block from the police department. I see all the vans and the news media from more than the local outlets. It's press from all over the place. How did they get here so fast? The police cars escort us around back and pull into a driveway that leads to the jail. It's blocked off so the press can't get there.
Where are they taking us? I ask.
Into the Sallyport. When you get out, the doors will be closed. They won't be able to film you.
Thank you, I say.
Listen, Casey, Billy says. I don't want you to talk to them unless I'm with you. Understood? The minute you talk without me, it's like waiving your right to have an attorney present. If you say you won't talk without one, they can't question you further unless you start it back up yourself. Clear?
Yes, but I don't have anything to hide. I want to tell them what I know.
And you can, but I want to direct this conversation and make sure you don't get yourself in more hot water. Until you get a criminal attorney, I'm going to look out for you.
So you think I could still be charged with murder?
Not if we can help it. For now, let's get you booked, and you just be quiet until I tell you that you can talk. We've got to stay in control of this.
In spite of his assurances, when we reach the garage under the building, some of the cameramen run to get as close as they can. A scratched yellow garage door slides open. Barbero pulls his car in behind the police cars that are still flashing their lights. It goes dark as the door closes behind us. Barbero unlocks his wheelchair and turns around, and his side doors come open. He rolls onto the hydraulic lift that lowers him to the ground. I get out of my seat and step down too. Immediately, the officers in the car in front of us are out of theirs. As they approach me, I hold out my wrists for them to cuff, but they don't. They walk me inside. Things get rougher as they put me through the paces of booking, as if I'm as much a criminal as a gang thug with 2 dozen murders under his belt. I send up a quiet, tearful plea to God to help me not to care about this. It won't hurt me to be humbled. I think about Jesus when he was in the custody of the authorities, being paraded before the religious leaders. But it was worse for him. He was beaten and spat at until he didn't even look like himself. Compared to that, this is nothing. They lead me to the camera, and I stare straight ahead, knowing this will be the picture that defines me for the next years of my life if I have to stay. They fingerprint me, roughly rolling my fingers across the ink pad. Instead of putting me in a holding cell, they take me to an interview room with a lock on the door. They park me there at a table with Billy by my side and leave me there alone with him. A few minutes later, 4 detectives come in. They look like they've been up all night. They introduce themselves, then two step out, and I know the others are watching through the window. The other two slide their chairs up to the table. They ask me what I'd like to drink, and I tell them a Diet Coke. Within a few seconds, someone has brought me one. I can do this, I tell myself. They don't seem hostile. It may be they're inclined to believe me after all that has happened. But I'm talking about their friend here, their co-worker, and some of them could be among Keegan's men. I wonder how Chief Gates has filtered them out to make sure they're not in on Keegan's crimes. I look around for the camera that is inevitably there, and I see it across the room from me up in a corner, filming everything we do. That actually might be my safety net. 50. Dylan. Once I know Casey is safe and that she's spending the afternoon in the interview room, and after I've gotten her family settled in the safe house, I join the police at Jim Pace's elegant cabin and walk them out into the woods where Casey saw them taking Jim's body. Jim isn't there. They bring the dogs out of the canine van, give them a whiff of Jim's clothing from the house. The dogs roam around picking up his scent, but never finding him.
Keegan came back to get him, I tell them.
They go through the house, checking out my story about where I was held, the blood on the door, the carpet strip I pulled up, the switch plate I loosened before Casey arrived. The CSIs take over the scene as the rest of us go back to the police station. I watch through the window as they interview Casey, as if it's a movie unfolding. I want so badly to go in there and help her with the story, but she's doing a great job laying it out. They have all the information we gave the press on a thumb drive, and they've been investigating it all morning. Keegan's house is a crime scene. His wife is sitting in another interview room, and his son Kurt is on suspension until he is debriefed. But Keegan is nowhere to be found. 51. Dylan. There's a sense of urgency as we strategize about finding Keegan. Two more detectives, Robinson and Parker, and a crime scene investigator have been suspended from the force as we zero in on those involved in his schemes. It turns out that Keegan doesn't have that many friends in the department. Those who are left are glad he's gone, or they're putting on a good face. The truth is that they're all under scrutiny, and if they even display an attitude, they're likely to come under investigation. They probably don't appreciate me coming in here with authority, but I don't have time to worry about that. I have a job to do, and lives depend on it. I stand in front of the whiteboards in the major crimes room, where I've copied the one I originally did on my paper roll. I've added what has happened in the last few days and hours. All eyes are focused on it. Though I'm not yet a detective, they all treat me like I'm one.
We've put out a bolo for Keegan's vehicle, Stamps tells me. I figure he's going to ditch it as soon as he can. I've got patrol officers checking out every rental car company to see if he's come by there. He's got a distinctive look, so I think his picture will alert people.
Though the media is all over him, plastering his face to Kingdom Come, I don't doubt that he can escape.
Are we still watching the airport?
Yes.
He says, they've been watching it since this morning. The TSA is alerted to watch for him on commercial flights, too.
I try to think like Keegan would think. When he realized he couldn't find us and that things were about to go south, he would have tried to get to his plane and leave the country. But if he feared being caught there, he could get out of town. But if he even suspected he'd be all over the news by morning, he would try to find a way out of the country. It's his only hope. Then it hits me.
I need to see the classified ads in every aviation magazine in a 300-mile radius.
For what?
Maybe he drove to another town and bought a plane.
But this came out first thing this morning. I don't think he could have bought one in the middle of the night. If he'd bought one this morning, the seller would have surely called it in when he saw him on the news.
I still get on my computer and pull up the website for Trade-A-Plane, which lists aircraft for sale all across North America. Keegan owns a Cessna 180. He would have wanted what he was familiar with. I type in single-engine Cessna 180, and up come 5 planes. One is in Canada, another in Las Vegas, so I rule those out. The other 3 are here in the South. One in Mississippi, one in Arkansas, and one in Texas. I print out the phone numbers for those sellers, and I call the closest one. The seller in Texas tells me no one has called about his plane. I try the one in Arkansas. Again, the seller hasn't been contacted. I call the one in Raymond, Mississippi. There is no answer, so I look at the listing and find a secondary number. I dial it, and a woman answers the phone.
This is Dylan Roberts from the Shreveport, Louisiana Police Department. I'm calling about the plane you have listed.
Yes. Really, it's my husband you need to talk to, Jake Gibbons, but he isn't here. You could call his cell.
She gives me the number I called first, and I tell her he didn't answer.
Could you just tell me if he's shown his plane to anyone today?
Yes, early this morning. He was meeting some guy at 7 o'clock. Guy called at 6 and said he had cash, but he needed Jake to show the plane to him right then. Jake hasn't come home. I look at my watch. It's 3 o'clock.
Did you expect him home afterward?
Yes. I knew he was probably taking the guy for a test flight, but he would have called me after to tell me how it went. He's been trying to sell it for the longest time, so I was anxious to hear. Why are you calling?
We're looking for someone we think may have been in the market in that area. Would you take my number and have your husband call me when he gets home? It's very important.
She hesitates.
This person, do you think he's dangerous?
I don't want to alarm her, so I don't tell her he's the one she's probably seen on the news all day.
Do you happen to have the number the buyer called from?
No, he called Jake's cell phone.
I was afraid of that.
Just have him call me, ma'am. Thanks for your help.
I hang up and yell,
"Pretty sure he was in Raymond, Mississippi!"
As the others come to my desk to hear more, I dial the Raymond, Mississippi Police Department and ask them to go check on that plane at the tiny Raymond airport to see if it's still there. I'm still filling the other detectives in and writing that bit of news on the whiteboard when my phone rings. It's the Raymond police.
"We thought you should know what we found.
Is the plane still there?"
"No, but we did find Jake Gibbons."
"You did? Where?"
"Dead in his car. Strangled."
I jump out of my chair.
"Do you have security footage?"
"We're getting it now.
I'm emailing you a picture of the guy we're looking for. I need to know if it's him. And while we're on the phone, I need to know the number of the person who called Gibbons at 6 this morning."
I hold while he goes to look. He finds the cell phone and checks the dead man's recent calls. He reads the number off to me. I give him my email and ask him to send the video so I can see it for myself. When I hang up, I go to the whiteboard and write the number the buyer called from. Maybe this will lead us to Keegan. 52. Keegan.
"This plane isn't fit to be flown. It's burning fuel twice as fast as my plane, which cuts my range in half. Flying from Mississippi, I couldn't be sure that I'd make it south across the Gulf to the Yucatan Peninsula for fuel. Even in my plane, that would have been iffy. So I've had to navigate west, hoping to stop to fuel up just inside of Mexico. Now I'm thinking my best bet is to land somewhere around Corpus Christi. But I wasn't prepared for this. I balance the chart on my knee and try to find a small private airport where I can self-announce. Since I'm not contacting Houston Center and I've turned off my transponder, I'm trying hard to stay under the radar. I have to find a small airport that doesn't have a tower, one that's self-fueling, so I won't have to come in contact with anyone who will recognize me, like I did this morning. That Jake Gibbons guy. He had it coming. I was waiting for him in the parking lot of his airport, fully willing to pay cash for his plane. But when I walked toward him in the parking lot, I could see on his face that he had already seen me on the news. His expression changed, and he muttered some excuse to get back in his car. As he reached for his phone, I opened the car door and took it out of his hand, and before he could react, I had my hands around his throat. When he stopped fighting back and I let him go, I checked for a pulse. He was dead.
I reclined his seat so it looked like he was taking a nap and wasn't immediately visible to others who might come and go. Bought me a few hours. And saved me a wad of cash, which is good since this plane isn't worth the price he was asking. On the map, I find a small airport just west of Corpus Christi, and I follow the coast of Louisiana on my way to Texas. Once I stop to fuel up, I won't have to stop again until I'm well into Mexico. As I fly, I scan the sky for other planes and listen to the radio for other flights in my area. I don't like flying without guidance from a tower, but it is what it is. I set my GPS with the coordinates that will take me to that little airport, then I unzip my duffel bag on the seat next to me, and I dig through for a baseball cap. I pull it on and look in the mirror. With the sunglasses, maybe people won't immediately think I'm the guy whose face is on the news. This never should have happened. I never should have been exposed. I was careful, covering my tracks, staging evidence, and paying people for their help. That slippery girl and that mental case never should have been able to find me out. I blame Rollins and Phillips and the others who weren't as careful as I was. Or maybe it was Candy. Maybe she was loose-lipped in Dallas, bragging about our relationship, and somehow word got back to Dylan Roberts. As I fly, I go back over the evidence they have on me now. Besides what they're already reporting on TV, they'll eventually find Jake Gibbons in his car. Will they realize I'm the one who took the plane? Will they arrest D.A. Phillips? Does he have the backbone to not expose everything else we've done? Will they find Jim Pace's body in my trunk at the Raymond Airport? There's no way I can allow myself to be seen before I'm out of the country, and even then I'll have to keep my head down as I make my way down Central America and into Ecuador. Now that I see how much fuel I'm burning, I'm wondering if I should have planned things differently. Maybe it would have been wiser to go to Cuba instead. No time for second guessing now. It'll be okay. Everything usually works out for me. I find the box of cigars I shoved into my bag and pull one out and put it in my teeth. I grab the matches and light it. It calms me and reminds me that I need to celebrate. I got all that cash from Rollins. Every penny he made under the table. And I can live well somewhere else. I'm almost home free. Dylan Roberts and Casey Cox haven't won. I have. I'm always the one who comes out on top. I take the cigar out of my mouth and laugh out loud. What am I worried about? I'll be in Corpus Christi in another hour. I'll fuel up on my own, and nobody will pay me the slightest attention. I'll hop into Mexico, refuel at Mexican airports during the night, and be in Ecuador by morning. Even with the shorter range in this plane, my plan will work. I'm almost home free.
53. Dylan. I'm studying the map and trying to figure out whether Keegan might head for Cuba or down into Mexico when a Raymond police officer calls me.
Thought you might be interested in this, he says. Jake Gibbons' wife mentioned that the Cessna Keegan stole has some problems. It's burning fuel faster than it should, which is why they've had a hard time selling it. So he has to stop earlier than we thought to refuel. Sounds like it.
As I get off the phone, I look at my map. If Keegan is headed for Cuba, he would have to stop in Florida to refuel. If he's going down to Mexico, he would have to go by way of Texas. He would probably have to stop somewhere in the southern part of Texas to refuel. There are a couple of FBI special agents here now working with us to get up to speed. Special Agent Griffin has been on the phone. He clicks it off, then steps toward me.
We've contacted the air route traffic control centers for Class B airspace to let them know to look for a plane that might not have contacted the tower and might have its transponder off.
That's not narrow enough, I tell him.
There are planes that don't even have transponders. If I were Keegan, I'd be looking for a small airport that doesn't have a tower and has self-fueling. That way he doesn't risk having to talk to somebody who might recognize him.
Agent Griffin gets back on his phone and puts out an alert to private airports in all the Gulf states. He also calls other agents working this case and orders them to put in calls to the private airports in case they don't see the alerts, starting with Texas and Florida. The other agent, named Baleo, yells across the room, "We just got a ping on Keegan's phone. The number he called Gibbons from this morning."
"Where is he?"
I ask. "He's just west of New Orleans."
"He must be going toward Texas."
I hustle back to my desk and open the aviation chart I've pulled up on my computer for South Texas. I try to figure out where he might have to land to refuel. There are small airports all over southern Texas. Dillinger, one of the detectives in the unit, looks over my shoulder and I show him how to identify the small airports.
"There are a lot of them,"
he says.
"How will we narrow it down?" "He would choose one that's self-announcing."
"Meaning?"
"It means there's no one there watching him land. No tower to talk to. Pilots have to announce their landing on the radio in case there are other aircraft in the area about to land on the same runway, and an airport that small usually has self-fueling pumps. He might never have to interact with anyone."
I print out the map on my screen, jerk it off the printer tray, and, with a red pen, circle all the small airports that fit that criteria.
"This one," I say. "I would choose this one just outside Corpus Christi. If he's burning fuel as fast as we hope he is, he wouldn't try to make it all the way into Mexico. He'd have to stop around Corpus. This airport is perfect. This is the one I'd choose."
The FBI agents get on the phone with Houston Center, the tower that tracks the planes in that region. With their radar, they locate a plane that hasn't contacted them and doesn't have its transponder on, in the vicinity where the phone pinged off the tower.
"I think we've got him," Baleo says.
54. Keegan.
By the time I locate the small runway west of Corpus Christi, my bladder feels ready to burst. I can't wait to get out of the plane to relieve myself, but I can't go inside to use the facilities because someone there might recognize me. I'll have to find a place outside. I self-announce my landing on the radio, knowing it's not going to be picked up by most people listening. Then I begin my descent. My landing is a little bumpy because this plane is about ready for the garbage heap, but I get the job done. I taxi to the tarmac. There's a small hangar with a couple of planes inside, and about half a dozen planes are tied down outside. I see the gas pumps and taxi toward them. Cigar in my teeth, I get out of the plane. I open the fuel cap and reach for the pump. I need a credit card. And that gives me pause for a minute. The ones in my wallet are in my name. I lean back into the plane and dig through my duffel bag for my fake passport and my alias credit card. I get back out and stick the credit card in, and when it's approved, I put the nozzle in and start filling the tank.
"Put your hands over your head and get down on the ground!"
I swing around. I'm surrounded. SWAT team guys with FBI on their vests and helmets stand at all angles ready to spray bullets into my brain. No! It's not going to end this way.
"Hands over your head, Keegan," someone repeats. "Get down on the ground."
I know they're going to shoot me if I go for my gun, but something deep inside me rages to the surface. As one last act of defiance, I pull the nozzle out and spray gas toward the three guys closest to me. Then I drop my cigar. Flames whoosh up as a bullet slashes through me, twisting somewhere in my side. My head hits concrete. My own clothes catch fire and I roll, trying to put out the flames. Searing pain in my flesh mingles with the nerve scream of that bullet through bone and muscle. Before I know it, they've put out the fire and are on top of me, my face down on the pavement, the smell of gasoline and gunpowder making me heave. They remove my gun and the knife in my pocket, cuffing my hands behind my back, knocking my forehead to the pavement. I'm bleeding and frying. I feel consciousness slipping away. In. Out. And things blur like the hazy fumes of the fuel.
55. Dylan. A cheer goes up in the major crimes unit as the FBI sends us video of their takedown of Keegan. It's all there. His fight to the end, his alias credit card, which may lead us to his offshore bank accounts. The trail of bodies on his way to get out of the country to escape prosecution. Chief Gates is in the room as we celebrate, and I see that he's more somber than the rest of us. He's slumped in a chair behind Keegan's desk, which has been cleared of his possessions, all taken into evidence.
You okay, Chief?
I ask.
Yeah, just not in the celebrating mood. All of Casey Cox's and your allegations are true. Right there, for everybody to see. There's a trail of dirty cops on my watch. It's about to get ugly. At least he can't kill anybody else.
I turn back to Special Agent Griffin, who's still with us.
What were his injuries? Gunshot wound on the right side, missed his lung, grazed some ribs, burns on his arms and legs. He can be patched up and flown back here on an FBI transport. Also, we got the surveillance video of the Gibbons homicide. It shows Keegan meeting him in the parking lot, then following him to his car and leaning in. He's not going to shake free of these charges. We have so much evidence against him now that he can't squirm his way out of this.
Chief Gates gets a call and walks out of the room. I wonder if I can get permission to go into the jail and give Casey the good news. I step out into the hall to follow the chief. I catch him on the stairs. He's just getting off his phone.
Chief, can I talk to you?
He turns.
I have good news for you, Dylan.
More? I ask.
It's about Casey. I was just talking to the AG. He saw the surveillance video and has reviewed all the evidence against Keegan, and he's considering dropping Casey's indictment for Brent Pace's murder. Considering? This should be a no-brainer. Just be patient. Casey will go before the judge tomorrow morning. She'll still have a few minor charges, even if they drop the murder charge, but my guess is he'll set a low bond for her. I want to be there. Feel free. And when she's released, you can take her to the safe house to join her family. She probably should stay there until we locate the rest of those involved in this.
I want to dance, to laugh, to hug Casey. Instead, I try to look professional.
Thank you, sir.
He shakes my hand.
No, thank you, Dylan. We couldn't have done all this without you today. Even the FBI told me you'd come through for them. I hope they don't hire you out from under me. I'm here as long as you want me. We need you. We have a lot of rebuilding to do. It's going to take an army of geniuses to dig out of this mess. At least I'll have one to start with.
I think of my mother, my father, my uncle, all those who have told me I'm worthless. I don't care if they never learn the truth. I know it, and God knows it, and so does Casey. That's all the validation I need. 56. Casey. I expected to be interviewed all day today, but they've left me alone in my cell. The time ticking by is ramping up my anxiety. If there were something to distract me, it would be easier. But in lockdown, there's no TV, no radio, no books. I spend a lot of time praying, and I force my mind to focus on gratitude. As Dylan was the first to point out to me, if I look for God, I'll see where he's working. I'm thankful for the 6-inch mattress on the metal bench bolted to the floor, and the blanket they've issued me. I'm thankful for the ill-fitting socks and the fact that I can pull my arms inside my jumpsuit and keep them warm. I'm thankful that they allowed me to shower this morning, and that the nurse practitioner looked at the wound that's healing on my shoulder and took out the stitches Dex sewed into me when he patched me up and gave me antibiotics. I'm thankful that Dylan is working in freedom to help find Keegan. I'm thankful that the guards have been kind, that one of them stood guard when I showered, that no one else has been allowed near me. I'm thankful that one of them said she remembers my father and that he deserved better than he got. I'm thankful that they've allowed me to call and talk to my mom and Hannah. I'm thankful that they're in a safe house where Keegan can't get to them. And as I doze into a light sleep, I thank God most of all for Dylan. I know he's working behind the scenes to help me. I feel safe in this place, no longer burdened by my load. Yes, time ticks slowly, but I trust that resolutions will come soon enough. 57. Dylan. I want to check on Casey, but I can't get clearance to see her, and they're not interviewing her, so I can't look in. Instead, I go check on her family. As I'm heading to the safe house, my phone rings. It's Special Agent Griffin.
Dylan, I wanted to let you know that we found Jim Pace's body. It was in the trunk of Keegan's car in the parking lot at the Raymond Airport.
Though his death doesn't surprise me, I can't help thinking about his poor wife finding out about this.
Has this been released to the press yet? No, not yet. We wanted to notify the family first. I'd like to go with whoever notifies her. I'm a friend of the family. I was about to go tell her myself. You can meet me there.
I'm somber as I drive to the Pace house, thinking of how I loved going over there when Brent and I were kids, how the place always smelled like cookies, how it was synonymous with happiness to me. I get there before Griffin, and I sit alone out front, remembering how high we used to climb that oak tree in the front yard. There was a tire swing his father had rigged up with a rope as thick as my arm, and we spun on it for hours until we were so dizzy we couldn't walk straight. The swing was cut down years ago. I feel a fierce longing for my old friend. I miss him. I never got to say goodbye. Griffin pulls up, and I blink back the mist in my eyes and get out of the car, wiping all expression from my face. I try to sort through what Elise might know from the news. Jim's name hasn't been released yet, and they haven't revealed that any of it happened on the Pace property. Elise answers the door when I ring the bell.
Dylan, I didn't expect to see you. I've been watching the news. I don't even know what to say. Nothing is what I thought it was. Why haven't you called me?
I'm sorry. I've just been so busy with it all. I thought maybe Chief Gates was keeping you informed.
No. It's like everybody's avoiding my calls.
I introduce her to Agent Griffin. She has company. Two women. And she introduces us to her sister and her niece and takes us into the kitchen to sit at the table I've eaten at so many times. As she sits down, she says,
I know you have a lot to tell us about the case, but I'm afraid Jim isn't home. He left to go out of town the night before last, and I haven't been able to get in touch with him to tell him about all this. I guess he's been busy. He hasn't answered any of my voicemails or texts.
I swallow the knot in my throat and reach out to take her hand.
Elise, that's why we're here. It's about Jim.
She tips her head and her eyes suddenly get a defensive expression, and she draws her hand back.
Please don't do this to me again.
I can't speak, and I look at Griffin. He's opening his mouth to say it himself, but I find my voice.
Elise, I'm so sorry, but Jim is dead. He was shot last night.
The two women are on her instantly as she crumples in her chair.
No,
she says.
He's not. It's a mistake.
I'm so sorry,
I whisper. She covers her mouth with her hand and sobs into it and tries to get up, but she falls back.
No. What? Tell me how this happened. Who did this?
Now I let Griffin take over.
Mrs. Pace, your husband was being blackmailed by Gordon Keegan. Because of that, he was complicit in some of Keegan's crimes.
No!
She shouts, cutting him off. She gets up, stumbles away. Her sister tries to bolster her, but Elise turns to me.
It's that girl.
She got to you. She's brainwashed you somehow. This isn't true. None of this is true.
Elise, her sister pulls her into her arms and holds her.
Honey, you knew something wasn't right. He had so many secrets. Not this,
she screams.
He wasn't involved in killing our son. He loved him.
I quickly take the reins again.
Elise, he didn't know about Brent. He would have never been involved in that. I told him about Keegan's involvement in Brent's death myself, and I'm absolutely positive it was news to him. He confronted Keegan. That's when they shot him.
She stares at me for a moment, her face twisted as if none of it makes sense to her.
So you're telling me that Jim didn't have anything to do with killing our son, but that he was involved with those other deaths, the extortion, the money laundering? What was he being blackmailed for?
I don't think we know yet,
I say, trying to soften the blow. I would give anything if I could spare her this pain, but it feels like I'm wielding the weapon that will kill her. I watch all the life drain out of her. Her face loses its color, and her lips blanch. Her legs buckle, and she drops to the floor. I spring up and go to her side as her crying niece kneels on the other side of her. I check her pulse, and her heart is racing in triple time. Griffin calls an ambulance while I try to revive her. Her eyelids flutter open, but she seems disoriented, confused. She lacks the strength to sit up.
Have I given her a stroke? I wait there with her until the ambulance arrives. Her vitals slowly come around as they load her into the back of it. Her blood pressure is rocket high. They think it was a fainting episode, and they say something about sedatives. I watch as they drive her away, praying that God will somehow help her through this darkness. As much of a victory as it is to have Keegan exposed, I know there will be some who still have to grieve. Maybe I'm one of them.
58. Dylan.
Because I'm still homeless, I spend the night in a motel near the safe house where Casey's family is, but I don't sleep well. Thoughts of her in that jail cell plague me. When I get back to the police department the next morning, Keegan is being booked after being flown here on an FBI plane. He's been treated for his gunshot and his burns, and now he's waiting to move into his new digs. He has dressings on his arm, like the ones I've had on my legs, and he holds his arm carefully because of the sutures in his gunshot wound. But he hasn't been humbled. He wears a sour expression, and the veins in his temples are protruding. He talks to the booking guards as if they're his old friends, but no one engages with him. When he catches sight of me, he yells across the room.
Here you got a job out of this whole thing, Dylan. No conflict of interest here, is there? Trumped up this whole thing, threw everybody you knew under the bus so you could get a job. When they dig through this mess, they'll find out the things you did. You and that girlfriend of yours. Watch your backs, guys.
Everyone in the area turns and looks at me, waiting for me to react, but I don't. Gordon Keegan has no power over me. Soon he's going to be in a jail cell, and the life he's chosen will be lived out the way criminal lives often end. He'll be around others like him, who've murdered and assaulted and stolen to feed their own appetites. He'll die in captivity, like I was supposed to at the lake house. I turn my back on him and walk upstairs toward the detective unit. Kurt Keegan is coming down the stairs. He looks pale and weary, as if he hasn't slept since the news broke. I slow my steps as I approach him, not sure what to say.
You okay, man?
He stops and looks over the rail toward the booking office, where he knows they have his father.
Just trying to help my mom through this. It isn't easy for her. Not for you either. He's getting what he deserves.
He rubs his mouth, and I can see the tears stinging his eyes red.
I just handed in my resignation. Why?
His voice is shaking, and I know he's on the edge.
Everybody's going to suspect me for the rest of my life. I'm his son. If you were involved, you'd have been arrested with him. I'll put in a good word for you. Don't leave. We need you.
Nah, I'm done.
He says,
for now I'm going to work for my future father-in-law's business. He's a good guy, trust me. Needs help with security. I can do that.
I can see that his mind is made up.
I'll pray for you, man. I'm so sorry. He killed all those people.
He whispers.
I knew he didn't have a heart. Now I know he doesn't have a soul either.
He does have one, I say.
It may be calloused, but he's accountable for it.
Kurt doesn't seem able to speak. He reaches out to shake my hand, then pats me on the shoulder and heads down the stairs. I say a silent prayer for him that this tragedy in his life won't sour the rest of his years. His wedding is coming up, and this will overshadow it. I pray that God will protect his and Grayson's joy as they become husband and wife. Later that day, I learn that Keegan is about to be arraigned even sooner than Casey. Because the press circles like vultures and the district attorney's office is plagued by charges of corruption, they've expedited this process to show they mean business. I squeeze my way into the courtroom and sit in the back row, trying not to draw attention. The gallery is full of press members. Keegan is wearing jail clothes, a red jumpsuit indicating violent crime charges, and he has shackles on his flip-flopped feet as he is taken before the judge. His lawyer stands beside him, one of the ones I've seen on the news locally. The gallery is so quiet that you can hear feet tapping. The judge reads Keegan's charges. Extortion, blackmail, obstruction of justice, kidnapping, homicide. My mouth goes dry as the charges are read out, and my heart is hammering. Keegan stands stiffly before the judge, his head tipped back arrogantly, as if this isn't fazing him.
Do you understand the charges?
The judge asks.
Yes, judge.
The attorney takes over. Your Honor, we request a preliminary hearing, at which time a plea will be offered. The nature of these charges and the public attention to this warrant that.
All right, we'll set a date for the preliminary hearing.
And, Your Honor, we'd like to request that you set bond for my client. We have every reason to believe that he can be trusted to appear in court.
My heart freezes, and I hold my breath. If they let him out, then it all continues.
He could still come after us. Casey won't be safe anywhere.
Bond is denied,
the judge says, and I let out that breath.
Defendant will be held pending the preliminary hearing.
I want to cheer as they escort Keegan out of the courtroom. He doesn't look into the gallery. He simply keeps his eyes down and makes his way out of the room. I don't like the idea that he's going to be incarcerated in the same building where Casey is, even if he is on a different floor in a separate part of the facility. I have to get her out of here. But time ticks by too slowly. 59. Casey. The prison phone system is a racket. I try calling the last burner phone Dylan had, but I don't expect to get through. In order for a call to go through on a cell phone, he has to buy a ton of minutes for like $400 and put it on his credit card. There's no charging by the number of minutes we've talked. Even my sister has had to give the automated system her credit card number so I can call her and my mom on Hannah's cell phone. I've promised to pay them back as soon as I get out. I don't know how most inmates can afford to talk to their families at all. Now I wait as the phone rings, and miraculously, Dylan picks up. Hello? I wait again as the automated message tells him that it's a call from the Caddo Parish jail and that he should enter a code if he's purchased minutes or press the number 1 to give his credit card. People often get flustered and frustrated as they scurry around, trying to get the proper information together to punch in. I had to give my sister 4 tries before she got it right. But Dylan simply types in a series of numbers, then the voice says, "You are connected."
Casey,
he says, his voice full of relief. How were you able to connect? I ask.
I signed up for the minutes. I'm so glad you called.
Okay, I'm impressed.
How are you? Are they treating you okay?
I'm fine, I say. They have me in lockdown, which is kind of boring, but I can live with boring.
They're trying to keep you separated from the population. We want you safe.
Yeah, it's fine. Do you know anything that's happening? He tells me about Keegan being arrested and brought in and denied bond, and how they've found the plane owner's body and Jim Pace's. My heart sinks for Brent's mom. She's lost so much. Her son, her husband. How will she survive this? Though I'm relieved that Keegan is where he should be, a desperate sadness falls over me at the thought of her grief.
I'm hoping they'll get you before a judge later today or tomorrow. They're waiting for paperwork and a press conference from the Attorney General.
I'm still in red, I say. They still have me classified as violent.
Everyone there knows you're not.
Have you talked to Billy Barbero?
Yes. He's been contacted by this famous attorney who wants to represent you. Sid Jameson.
The name rings a bell. Who is he?
A celebrity attorney. He got that woman off who drove her car with her child in it into a lake, then jumped out and let her baby die. Remember?
I shiver. I don't want to be represented by someone like that.
I thought that too at first, he says. But Casey, if they don't do the right thing, you need somebody like him. Somebody whose ego is involved in fighting for you. The public scrutiny will make him do the best thing for you.
But I don't need all that, do I? I'm really innocent. Besides, I can't afford it.
He offered to do it pro bono. Barbero is on the way to the airport to pick him up now. Jameson is a publicity hound. That might work in your favor. It's worth talking to him.
But if I go to court tomorrow, can I just use Barbero?
Yes. You don't have to offer a plea tomorrow. Barbero can ask for bond.
My voice catches, and I try to steady it. I want you to know that if I don't get released, I'm okay here. I can do this.
You can do anything, he says. Remember a few months ago when I told you that you were the bravest person I know? I still mean that.
My brave girl. My dad's endearment hangs in my heart. Thank you, Dylan. You're the bravest man I know.
I didn't think it was even possible to miss someone this much, he says.
Once again, I can hardly speak. He gets quiet, too. Finally, I ask, so how is it being on the force?
It's great, he says. It was especially great helping them find Keegan. I want to help rehabilitate the image of the force. Keegan has done unspeakable damage.
To a lot of people, I say.
He's going to pay. His days of getting away with everything are over.
I think of my father and of Brent's promise snuffed out so prematurely. No amount of punishment would be enough for a man like Keegan. The next morning, I get up early and ask if I can take a shower, and they take me into the bathroom where I use the harsh, all-in-one shampoo to wash my hair. Then I let it air dry as I go back to my cell. We're passing the elevator when the doors open and two guards rush out. They go into the guards' station, and I hear them excitedly telling the other guards,
District Attorney just killed himself.
What?
The guard with me asks, are you serious?
Yes, he was in C block. Managed to cut his carotid artery and bleed out before anyone knew it had happened.
Was he in the cell alone?
Yes, but he wasn't on suicide watch. Not sure what he used, but...
The voices fade as I'm escorted down the hall to my cell. I look back as my door opens. The guards seem as excited as if they've just won a lottery pool. I step back into my cell, and the door is locked behind me. So the DA is gone. He can't hurt anyone else. But I can't help feeling the pain of his family. The shame of his death, along with the horror of knowing what he was involved in, how will they ever overcome it? I get on my bed and pull my knees up to hug them, and I pray for all the people who will be impacted by that man's choices. Later that morning, I'm loaded into the van with the others going to court. It's a relief to hear the buzz of women's voices around me as I take my seat.
You Casey Cox? One of the women asks me. I look back at her and nod. Half of her head is shaved, and she has a tattoo of a Mustang on her scalp.
How'd you hide all that time?
She asks gleefully, as if I'm a criminal celebrity. I turn back to the front without answering.
You can't talk?
The woman blurts. Not about that, I say. Leave her alone, someone else tells her.
She ain't done nothing.
The woman behind me is suddenly distracted by my defender, and as they go back and forth, I let my mind drift as we drive the short distance to the courthouse. The press swarms around the front steps. The van turns into a small garage and takes us into another sallyport where it lets us out. They lead us all single file into a holding room and tell us they'll take us into court when it's time. There's a guard at the door, but she's reading something on her phone. After a moment, she steps out of the room. Something whams me from behind, and I'm knocked to my face. I flip around, trying to see what hit me. One of the inmates is straddling me, and her rough hands close around my throat, choking me. I swing my arms and fight, trying to get her off of me, and I manage to loosen her grip. She swings and hits me in the eye, then comes back down and her knuckles smash against my lips. Her hands close around my throat again. Some of the women are screaming for help, and the guards rush in and wrestle her off me. I get to my feet, gasping for breath and wiping blood from my eyelid and my lip. I hear someone chewing out the guard for stepping out, and things seem to move in slow motion as they take me out of the room and to a bathroom so I can wash my face. My eye and bottom lip are swelling. I pray there aren't cameras in the courtroom. Two guards sit, one on either side of me, after that, and in a few minutes they tell me it's time. I don't want my family or Dylan or the press to see me like this, bloody and swollen, but I can't prevent it. I walk in, my head down until I'm facing the judge. The bailiff whispers something to him, and he frowns and adjusts his microphone.
Miss Cox, I've just been told what happened in the holding room.
Billy wheels up beside me.
Your Honor, we asked that you keep her out of the general population, and this is why. This is ludicrous. I agree, the judge says. Miss Cox, I'm very sorry.
Billy keeps going.
Your Honor, in light of this situation, surely you see that my client should be given bond. Her murder charges were dropped by the state's attorney this afternoon.
I catch my breath. Relief pounds through me.
Her remaining charges are only misdemeanors, and she's suffered so much that you must see how unwise it would be to hold her in the same population where her tormentors are also being held.
I look at the floor, resigned to having to get back into that van with those women, where it could happen again. Keegan has probably paid someone off. He's not going to go down without a fight. When the judge grants bond at $10,000, I look up at him, stunned. Billy whispers,
"You only have to put $1,000 down. We'll get a bail bondsman here within the hour."
That means
you're about to be released.
I burst into tears and turn to see my family and Dylan sitting together in the courtroom behind me. They're celebrating and hugging, but then they see my face and their smiles fade. My mother bursts into tears. I hate it. I didn't want them to have to live with this. I want to go to them, but I haven't been released yet.
When you're released,
Billy is saying as he wheels beside me to wherever the guards are taking me,
we're going to take you in front of all those cameras and let the world see what they did to you.
I don't want to do that. I just want to lie down. I feel bruises forming on my throat.
We'll wait right here until they process you out, he says. You won't have to go back that way.
Not in the van? I ask, my voice raspy. Not with those women?
No, they'll release you from here.
I close my eyes and let the tears flow and thank God for what he's done. A little while later, when my bond has been paid, I'm allowed to put my clothes back on and have my possessions. I step out of the back room and see my family waiting. They rush to hold me, and I'm passed from Hannah to my mother to Jeff, and then Jeff passes little Emma to me. I weep as I kiss her, shocked at how big she's gotten since I saw her last, and she looks up at me and studies my face, perplexed. I cover the side where my eye is swollen and play peekaboo. She seems to recognize me then and grins, her little dimples cutting into her cheeks. I had forgotten her dimples. Dylan steps through them, and still holding Emma, I step into his arms. He kisses my hair as he holds me, but he's not smiling.
What did she do to you?
Tried to strangle me, I say, shifting Emma to my good side. I smile at her as she touches my face.
A Keegan stooge, he says. It could hurt someone. But I just checked, and if it's any consolation, it's all on videotape. The woman is in for second-degree murder. $100 was put on her books today. We think it was payment for what she did.
My life for $100?
It's like gold in jail. There were probably other payments promised.
I don't know why I'm so emotional, but I can't stop my tears. I hug Emma against me, hiding my tears from her.
Are we going to be safe? I don't want to bring danger to my family.
We're going to keep you in the safe house for now. All of you. I'll take you there myself.
I hug him again and whisper in his ear,
Will you be able to hang out with us there?
Just try and get rid of me,
he says with a grin. 60. Dylan. I've just gotten Casey and her family to the safe house when a phone call from Elise Pace comes. I didn't expect to hear from her, but she asks if she can come visit me at home and talk. I tell her I still don't have a place to live, but I agree to meet her at a restaurant. I'm curious what she has to say. She shows up at exactly 4 o'clock, a perfect meeting time since the restaurant is almost empty. I don't know whether or not to hug her, but she leans over and hugs me and presses a kiss on my cheek. We sit down and she squeezes my hand.
I'm so sorry about your apartment burning, Dylan. I really don't think Jim knew about any of that. He wouldn't have allowed it.
No, I don't think he did.
Tears rim her eyes.
It's wrong what happened on so many levels. I wish he were still here so I could ask him what he was thinking, giving in to blackmail. Bringing all this on us.
I don't know what to say, so I just stay quiet. She dries her eyes and sits up straighter.
Don't worry, I'm not going to fall apart again.
She draws in a long breath.
I wanted you to know that I've been digging back through financial records, trying to figure out what part of our finances was criminally gained, what part was legitimate income. Back about 15 years ago, Jim went through a rough patch in his business. He'd made some risky investments and he lost a lot of money. I think it must have been then that he sold corporate secrets to a rival company. Keegan was probably targeting him to blackmail for something, anything, because Jim was rich. By the time Keegan figured out what Jim had done, Jim was the CEO of the company he had betrayed. And he had investors and shareholders to answer to. He couldn't let that get out. If Jim had just told me he was in trouble. I didn't have to live in that big house. I often wondered if it was best to bring Brent up in that way. I would have been happy living in a regular neighborhood and downscaling our life. But I never got the chance to weigh in on that. Because he never told me we were having problems.
I know you always made Brent your priority over everything, I say. You were just a great mom. That's how I thought of you.
She bursts into tears again and squeezes my hand.
I can't tell you how much that means to me, Dylan.
She looks up at the ceiling tiles.
I miss Brent so much. All this, if I could turn back time and know what was going on. If I could intervene somehow.
What could you have done?
I don't know,
she whispers. She forces her posture straighter again.
I really didn't come here to do this. I came to tell you something else. Something good. At least I hope you'll think so.
What?
I wanted to tell you how sorry I am for thinking that girl, Casey Cox, did this to Brent. I'm proud of you for figuring all this out and exposing everything, even when it meant going against Jim and me. Brent would have wanted you to do that. I know he would.
He sure wouldn't have wanted the wrong person accused of his murder.
No, he wouldn't.